Okay, any preliminary questions? I'm still working on the exams, for those of you who are interested in that. You heard the word exam and your ears perked up, I know. So, but I'm still working on it. Oh, also, today is Q&A. So, 4 p.m. Any other preliminary issues? Okay, we left off last time just on the verge of section B here, starting on page 44. And the issue is, again, distinguishing but-for cause from legal cause. We spent all that time trying to identify those cases in which but-for causation would be a problem and how we would cope with some request to modify that but-for cause standard. As we shift over into legal cause, we look at those cases where, in effect, we may acknowledge that but-for causation can be established. This was a cause without which the injury would not have occurred, but for essentially a variety of policy reasons, the defendant would argue that liability shouldn't be imposed. And as I think I said on Wednesday, the language of Justice Kennard back in the Mitchell versus Gonzalez case is helpful here, where he described legal cause as a normative evaluative question. That is, unlike but-for causation, which is what happened, what would have happened if the defendant had used reasonable care, it's not so much a question of what happened with respect to legal cause, it's a question of what do we think is the proper treatment of what happened. The first case we have, which I think I mentioned only very briefly, is this Berry versus Sugar Notch, which raises, again, this question of how do you distinguish something that's a but-for cause, on the one hand, from that which is properly said to be a proximate cause. Can somebody tell us about Berry versus Sugar Notch? Mr. Edwards. Trolley company. And in the case, I'm gonna sort of transpose it a little bit for those of you musically inclined. You can transpose from one key to another. Here I'd like to transpose this case a little bit so that instead of looking at it as the case really was, where he's the plaintiff and his negligence is being used as the basis to deny him a recovery, let's assume for purposes of our discussion that there was a passenger on this trolley car who was suing him and his employer for negligently causing injury when the tree fell on the trolley car. So I think the same analysis of what constitutes proximate cause works, and most of the time we're not interested so much in contributory negligence. We're interested in whether or not the plaintiff should be able to recover from the defendant. So with that in mind, let's suppose that the passenger says the trolley company is responsible for the injuries suffered when the tree fell on the trolley car. how did they go about establishing that the defendant was negligent? Okay. So with respect to Chapter 1, the argument is a reasonable person would have been obeying the speed limit. He was not. He was traveling above the speed limit, and therefore his conduct was negligent. Okay. Chapter 1, let's assume we sort of check off here Chapter 1. Now we're in Chapter 2. What's the plaintiff's burden in Chapter 2? Okay. And how is the speed a proximate cause of his injury? Well, taken by itself, if our only question was whether or not you could say, gee, if it hadn't been for his speeding, this accident would not have occurred, we might answer that in the affirmative. But there's more to it. That's the whole point of leading off this section with this case, is to say there's more to the question of proximate cause than simply, is this a cause without which the accident would not have occurred? Now, just so we're clear about the facts of this particular case, the court poses a slightly different hypothetical in which they say, had the accident occurred in this other way, then proximate cause would apply. What other way, hypothetically, would make a difference in our analysis? What's the alternative hypothetical they pose? Yes, Ms. Hucker. I'll give her a chance here. Okay, that's the alternative, and they say there we would be happy to call speeding a cause of that accident, but we're not prepared to say that speeding was a cause of this accident. What's the difference? Well, suppose he's going 12 miles an hour, and let's suppose with this trolley, the way it's constructed, it takes him 100 feet to stop this at that speed. And let's suppose the tree falls over when it's 20 feet away, and he crashes into the tree. Then what? He has no notice, but he wouldn't have had any notice at 8 miles an hour either. Okay, at least one of the things we could say about that accident is that the faster you go, the more likely it is you're going to run into a tree. Speeding affects the likelihood of crashing into a fallen tree. Not because I could have stopped in time, but the faster I go, the more trees, in effect, I would hit. Going 200 miles an hour, for example, I would hit a lot more trees than if I'm going at 2 miles an hour. By contrast, if we're talking about the tree falling on the car, going 2 miles an hour or 200 miles an hour makes no difference in terms of the risk of being hit by a falling tree. So again, the court is looking to the relationship between the negligent act and the injury, saying not only was it in addition to being a but-for cause, was it the kind of cause that tends to cause this sort of injury. Let's say, for example, I leave my cell phone here, and I get, suppose it's my last class in the day, and I pick up my belongings, and I head to the car. I'm getting into the car, and I realize, oops, I left my cell phone. I walk back from the parking lot, find my cell phone on the table, go back out to the parking lot. It's now 5 minutes later from the first time I started to get into my car. I get into my car, pull out onto the freeway, and there's a semi out of control that crashes into me and causes me serious injury. Would your response to that be those damn cell phones? No. Even though cell phones do cause some injuries, had I been trying to make a call on my cell phone or check my email and took my eyes off the road, and when I looked up again, there was this semi out of control, but I don't have the opportunity. Then we would say trying to use your cell phone while you're driving does increase the likelihood that you're going to get into an accident where you needed your full attention. But leaving my cell phone on the podium doesn't increase the risk that I'm going to get squashed by a semi-truck. You can say it's a but-for. If it had not been for my cell phone, I would have been 5 minutes further down the freeway, never would have had that, never would have been involved. But it's not the kind of thing, again, as we look to those things which we attribute as proximate causes, we look to things we can fairly blame. So Berry versus Sugar Notch illustrates the difference between what might be called a sort of random occurrence, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and one in which the defendant's negligence enhances the likelihood not just of accidents in general, but of this particular kind of accident. Okay, we get to apply this to a more recent, modern case in Channel versus Mills, which actually cites Berry versus Sugar Notch. It's got two ends in it, so I say it's... I'm totally unprepared to make any witty remarks here, so I'll think of one later. But I'm at a loss right now. Okay. Hey, meanwhile, yeah. I think she's actually heading west. This is my image of it. If it's out of whack, you can correct me. So they're switched here. Okay, that's a good correction. We got Anderson over here, and then we got Mills, the defendant, heading south. Okay. Okay, so there are two different theories the plaintiff proposes at trial. One theory is I had a green light, the defendant had a red light, he should have stopped, I was entitled to go through the intersection. The other theory, sort of in the alternative, was even if he had the green light and I had the red light, yes, he at least shares in the fault in causing this accident, because his speeding was one of the causes of the accident. Okay, so what happens when the plaintiff presents these two theories at trial? Yes, and again, Hornbook law on this point, which again reinforces the dissenting opinion in Mitchell versus Gonzalez, to say most jurisdictions use this two-part test as the court describes. Okay, go ahead. But I want to sort of finish the story of what happened at the trial court just so we know how the case gets set up on appeal. When the plaintiff has these two theories at trial, how are they evaluated? Who doesn't accept it? Okay, and what was, if the judge had been more open to this, what would the plaintiff have done? What I'm trying to get you to say is that the plaintiff offered expert testimony about the effect of speed, and the trial judge said, no, I don't think that speed is relevant to this case. Okay, and then just to finish the story, so we get the case properly set up on appeal, the case then goes to the jury, and the jury makes findings on the other theory, red light, green light. Yes, so they reject the plaintiff's theory on the red light, green light. In fact, just the reverse, they say that the plaintiff had the red light, so the plaintiff is at least partially at fault by not paying attention to the color of the light. But the plaintiff is grumpy about the fact that she wasn't allowed to pursue the speeding theory. And appeals court tells us, why did the trial judge reject the plaintiff's expert on this point? And before we get there, what was the plaintiff's argument as to why speed affected this particular case? Why does going 51 rather than 35 miles an hour affect the outcome here? Okay. Mr. Case? Well, that's the part that the plaintiff's least likely to get any play on, because that's the part of sort of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. But this idea about perception has a little more traction, as it were, that if you're going 2 miles an hour, you have more time to see what's coming up in the intersection than if you're going 75. It's 75 miles an hour coming through this intersection. You have a lot less time in which to recognize, gee, I've got a green light, but there's someone else coming through the intersection. Let me see if I can swerve to avoid them or put on my brakes or do something else. Why doesn't that fly in this case? Why shouldn't the trial judge have at least allowed the plaintiff to take a run at that? Ms. Rush? Okay. And did the experts supply the kind of data that would show, gee, at 35 miles an hour, this is what you can see, but at 51 miles an hour, this is what you can see, and here's the difference. At least not to the trial judge's satisfaction. And again, it's understandable with the emphasis at trial upon red light, green light, that's kind of where most of the attention was focused, that it's only in retrospect that we now examine the plan B or plan C or whatever it was that the plaintiff had as a kind of backup. And the trial judge, not finding the plaintiff's expert to be really well grounded on this point, to say, if your testimony is that at 51 miles an hour there's something you can do to avoid this, excuse me, at 35 miles an hour there was something you could have done to avoid it, that there was a window of opportunity that closed because you're going 51, well, that, I think, would be fair game for the plaintiff to present to the jury. But if it sounds more like simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time, that would only serve to confuse the jury. Now, one of the difficulties being a trial judge is that your job is like an umpire's calling balls and strikes, or, you know, a field judge in football deciding whether somebody caught the ball or had 2 feet in bounds, or, you know, other sorts of judgment calls. And when you scrutinize these things later with the instant replay and the slow motion cameras from all sorts of different angles, you sometimes look at these things and say, that wasn't quite as close as you thought it was. But here again, the appeals court, looking back at the trial judge's decision to allow or disallow this evidence, didn't find that the trial judge made a mistake. Instead, they said, if to the extent that the jury was being invited, in effect, to do a Berry versus Sugarnotch, wrong place at the wrong time, we want to make it clear that that kind of claim doesn't work. You have to show that the defendant's conduct made the accident more likely to occur, not just accidents in general, but that it had the effect of increasing the risk of this particular kind of accident. If all it did was, again, to put the plaintiff in the wrong place at the wrong time, put the defendant in the wrong place at the wrong time, that's not enough. Questions about, go ahead. Yes. Okay. And that may be by itself potentially misleading, in that it's not just that it causes an accident or not, but it enhances an accident. So just as with the kid falling off the bridge, the defendant's negligence may have made the difference between a dead kid and a seriously injured kid, similarly, if the defendant's speed makes the difference between broken bones, and in this case a dead passenger, then speed is relevant. But to the extent that it's not something where speed would have made a difference in the outcome, then you don't have the basis for proximate cause. So again, proximate cause is both of these aspects, not only to say, but for the defendant's negligence, there would have been no injury, but also the defendant's negligence increased the risk that this kind of accident would not have occurred. Increased the risk that this kind of accident would occur. You may recall, again, back in Tedlow versus Ellman, the court's distinction, if this is helpful, between an attendant cause and an efficient cause. An attendant cause is one that just happened to be there. An efficient cause is one that sort of propelled the action forward in that direction. Again, my leaving my cell phone on the podium may be an attendant cause of my later being in an auto accident, but it's not an efficient cause in the sense that you would say the cell phone caused that accident. It wouldn't have made any difference if I'd forgotten my cell phone or my glasses, or for that matter, if I wanted to stay an extra 5 minutes to finish up a conversation. None of those things could fairly be blamed for my being in a collision later on just because I was in a different place because of that 5 minute delay. Okay, questions about increased risk again versus mere chance? Mr. McElmanus. I'm sorry? Well, again, it may be that the case against Anderson is even weaker from the standpoint that by the time Anderson, also, I think Anderson actually went through the intersection. It was actually the plaintiff who collided with Mills. So it would be much harder to show that Anderson's negligence in that sense caused the accident. Well, and if Anderson's fault, as you describe it, is that Anderson blocked Mills' view, or you could blame, you know, hey, Mills says the guy next to me is going 51. I figured it was okay to go 50. I mean, these get so remote from saying, can you really blame me because I'm going 51 miles an hour because the guy next to me wanted to keep up with traffic and so was going too fast. It seems like a strange sort of argument. Ms. McLaughlin? I thought I made a mistake, but I was wrong. All right. Works for me. Again, the point is that you need to have a connection between the defendant's negligence and the plaintiff's injury such that you can say the defendant's negligence was a proximate cause of this accident, not just a happenstance cause, but one, again, where we employ this legal cause criterion, fair to impose liability, along with saying it's also a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. Okay, now our second area of legal cause involves a different kind of consideration, again, sharing the same quality of being a normative evaluative question, but let me sort of draw the essential layout of this. What you have in a scenario like the ones we're going to consider is a situation in which the defendant, the target defendant, deep pocket defendant, institutional defendant, does something negligent which facilitates a bad guy, car thief, murderous boyfriend, etc., in causing injury to the plaintiff. So the defendant sells a hunting rifle to a guy who's drunk. The defendant leaves keys in a car that gets stolen by a car thief who then runs over the plaintiff. You have some other scenario in which the defendant's negligence allows someone else to do a bad thing, typically a criminal thing. And what the defendant will argue is there is no proximate cause relationship between the defendant's negligence and the plaintiff's injury true, there's a but-for cause relationship. If I hadn't left the keys in the car, it wouldn't have been stolen by that car thief. Car thief wouldn't have run over the plaintiff. But whatever negligent thing I did was superseded. There is a superseding cause of the injury to the plaintiff, and you can't connect the dots, so to speak. Working back from the plaintiff's injury, you can't trace the chain of proximate cause all the way back to the defendant. The chain of causation is broken by this superseding cause. The defendant, by contrast, the plaintiff, by contrast, argues that the chain of causation is complete, that you can connect the dots. Why shouldn't Kmart sell a hunting rifle to a drunken customer? Because drunken customers with hunting rifles do bad things. In this case, the guy took the hunting rifle home and shot his girlfriend with it. Now, there are other things you could imagine, bad things that people would do if they're buying hunting rifles when they're drunk, but this is one of many that could have been anticipated, should have been anticipated, and it's fair and appropriate to hold the target defendant liable for the injury the plaintiff suffered. Now, in contrast, again, it's the defendant who will characterize it as a superseding cause. The plaintiff will characterize it as a merely intervening cause. And again, the difference is, in one, the chain of causation remains intact. You can trace the causal chain from the defendant's negligence to the plaintiff's injury. In the other, the causal chain has been broken. Now, as with the other areas in this section, we are doing this normative evaluative analysis, deciding, well, what do we think is fair? Should Kmart be responsible for the criminal things that people do with hunting rifles sold to them while they were intoxicated? Or should they not be? And it's important for you as you look at fact patterns on an exam that you first of all identify this paradigm, that you've correctly said, my case lines up like this. Here's the target defendant. The plaintiff would certainly like to blame the target defendant, but the target defendant has a plausible argument that what somebody else did was a superseding cause of the injury and broke the chain of causation. Okay, with that sort of introduction, let's talk about Ms. Rush. What's that? I don't know. Potentially another driver in the case, I don't know. Alphonse, I think, was his partner, wasn't that? Alphonse and Gaston, I can't remember. It's possible. I can't tell you from the... Okay, can somebody tell us about this little risky business gone awry here? Simpson? Albrecht, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what is the defendant's argument, that is, what is Oscar's argument as to why they're not liable for the injury suffered by the plaintiff? Okay, now let's suppose that we collapsed this part of it, took this part of it out. Oscar sells the beer to Fitzpatrick, who consumes it, drives drunk, and injures the plaintiff. Would they have much of an argument then? Would you say, gee, it was unforeseeable to us that by selling alcohol to a minor, that the minor would consume it, and that's not a very good argument, is it? If Oscars had sold the beer directly to the driver who consumed it and got into a wreck, that's one of the many reasons why we don't want convenience stores selling alcohol to minors. We also don't want, you know, the minors have other problems when they get drunk, but one of the main things we're concerned about is their ability to drive. However, Oscar says that given this scenario, we can't connect the dots between their negligence in selling the alcohol to Rettenmeier and the plaintiff's injury. The superseding cause in this case might be actually the distribution of the alcohol. Now, one of the things that Oscars wants to argue is the role of Rettenmeier. Is Rettenmeier liable for this accident? Okay. Okay. Ironically, Oscars is a cause of this accident, but Rettenmeier is not. How do we get there from here? Well, go ahead. Okay, so Oscars, who, let's assume for purposes of discussion, Oscars believes, negligently so, that Rettenmeier is of age. Oscars negligently sells Rettenmeier beer. For that, they have they're potentially liable. But Rettenmeier, who knows he's underage, and furnishes this alcohol to Fitzpatrick in this party, Rettenmeier, as a matter of law, is not liable. Does that make sense? Yeah. Mr. Tucker, go ahead. Okay, this whole idea of social host, let's talk about that for a second. Suppose you come to my house for a dinner party along with other people, and I serve alcohol, and I notice that you're, I know you came to my house, you asked me for driving directions, and I knew you drove there, I knew you're going to have to drive home, Notwithstanding that fact, and notwithstanding other people telling me as I open a new bottle of wine or mix up a new pitcher of margaritas, somebody tells me, watch Mr. Albrecht. I think he's had a little more than he should. He's got to drive home, you know. And I say, not in my house, you know. I want to make sure that he has as much as he wants. I continue to serve you more than you should have. You get into a car, you hit somebody on your way home because you're legally impaired. Can I be held liable for that? Even though I've been told, I've been warned, I know that you've had more than you should have, I know that you're going to drive home, why can't I be held liable? No, I can't. I know that much. Even a commercial host is not liable to you for what you do to yourself. But a commercial host can be held liable for what you do to somebody else, but not a social host. I'm, in effect, immune. Now, if you're a minor, I'm in a different spot. But if it's an adult serving to an adult, or in this case, a minor serving to a minor, no social host liability. Why not? So even if the evidence is absolutely clear that I knew about it and took some pleasure in getting you drunk, notwithstanding that, I have no liability. Okay, and to whom does the court look for guidance in this matter? What's that? Well, in one sense, they look to the jury, but they say, in effect, you may not like this logic here. You may say that as between the busy clerk at the convenience store that's, you know, processing the people through the convenience store and sells somebody some alcohol, who turns out to be a minor, between that person and the social host who deliberately or knowingly serves someone who shouldn't be served, it may be that by force of logic, one would be more deserving of liability than the other, but after all, the legislature's made this call. This is a normative, evaluative judgment about where the responsibility should fall that has been made by the people in the legislature. And if the people of the state of Washington don't like that rule, if it seems illogical, they have the 800 number of the legislature and they can call their legislatures and tell them what law they want instead. Yeah. Okay, but again, do you want to put the responsibility in the hands of the jury to say, look, we don't want to crimp anybody's style. If you have a party and you have an ice chest full of beer and people serve themselves and we're all adults here and we leave it up to the individual to monitor their own alcohol consumption, who's going to get a ride home with whom? We understand that in the reality of modern life, it's not always easy to do this kind of stuff. But why do we have a rigid rule that prevents a jury under the right circumstances from saying, well, ordinarily this is a tough judgment call, but here it would have been real easy and you blew it? Why don't we give the jury that freedom? Well, again, the court says the legislature has not chosen to do that. If the legislature wants to, let them do so. But who are we, the court, to, in effect, override what the legislature has chosen? Now, there are some dissenting opinions here that say it is not quite accurate to say that the legislature has chosen to immunize social hosts from liability. What the legislature has done is to selectively impose legislative statutory liability. They made commercial hosts liable pursuant to this statute. They never said in so many words, and social hosts are not liable. The courts, according to the dissenting judges, could impose liability without doing anything contrary to what the legislature has said. But there's a principle in statutory construction which you will encounter. I believe the Latin phrase is expressio unius et exclusio alteris, something like that. My Latin's not very good. But the point is, to express one thing is to exclude the other. So if I have three children and I say Johnny and Mary may go to the park, and I make no mention of Susan, my third child, then you can, although I've never said explicitly Susan may not go to the park, if Susan went to the park after hearing that this is what her parents said, she'd probably face some wrath at that point. The implication from saying these two may go to the park is that, hey, I've considered the third and decided something different. So, again, when the court looks at what the legislature has done, and again, thinking to itself, the regulation of people's consumption of alcohol is not an obscure technical feature of the law. This is something where we can reasonably expect the legislature to do something if there is a will to do it. Their failure to do something reflects a lack of legislative will to do so. Again, the court is making an inference about what its proper place is. But again, the main thing I want you to recognize here is the pattern. Deep pocket defendant, bad actions in the middle, plaintiff gets hurt. Can you hold the defendant liable? Even if the defendant is negligent, the defendant escapes liability if the defendant satisfies us that the defendant's negligence was interrupted by a superseding cause. That you cannot trace the plaintiff's injury beyond this bad act to some cause further back in the history. As long as you recognize this, and again, recognize that the distinction or the differentiation is this normative evaluative process. It's not a technical issue. It is one in which, as the judges did here, they're in effect making some kind of public policy. They're deciding whether it's fair to blame this defendant for what subsequently happened. Then you'll be prepared to say, well, gee, if I'm the defendant, I'm going to make a superseding cause argument. If I'm the plaintiff, I'm going to say the chain of causation was not broken. It's a merely intervening cause, says the plaintiff, not as the defendant would have it, a superseding cause. Yeah. Well, to sort of spoil the fun later on, foreseeability is one of the factors. Well, that might be the plaintiff's own negligence, which affects the plaintiff's right to recover, but before we impose a duty on the defendant, we have to decide, in effect, when defendants sell alcohol to minors, are they responsible for cases like this? And again, the court is saying, with one exception, Justice Sanders disagrees, but all the other judges say Oscars is accountable for the harm that arises from this sale. Let's pick that up tomorrow.